An estimated 5 million people have Alzheimer's disease in the United States, and that number will only get bigger as the baby boomers age. David Schenck is the author of The Forgetting. He says cases of Alzheimer's go way back in history.
The earliest one I was able to find was the sun god Ra, who was reputed not only to be immortal and omnipotent, but eventually senile. That was 2800 BC, by the way. So there's several thousand years of recorded human history, and pretty steady at that, of references to senile dementia. Not until the 20th century did we start to think of it as a disease, which of course is only a social construction. It's us deciding as a culture that this is now something that we want to fight, that it's a disease, and as a medical community, it's important for us to fight it.
So it really was this century when it finally began to be realized that this was a disease and that we could begin looking into why it was happening. What was the instigus for that?
Well, the conventional history starts in 1901 when a woman named Auguste D. walked into a mental hospital in Germany with these symptoms that we now recognize as Alzheimer's disease, these bizarre short-term memory problems and some confusion and some paranoia. And her doctor was, in fact, Alois Alzheimer, who was this outstanding, gregarious, very creative, hardworking scientist and physician. And the extraordinary thing that happened at that time was that he not only followed this woman's condition, this woman's progress, as it were, deterioration through several years, but then after she died, he was also the one to look inside her brain, and he was the one to, for the first time, notice these strange plaques and tangles that had accumulated in her brain.
Tell me more about the plaques and tangles. What are they? Where do they come from? Do we know?
Where do they come from? That's the $9 zillion question. They do not exist in any other disease or natural form. The plaques are these strange kind of black, sticky balls of goo that are made up of this substance called beta amyloid. They know roughly how they form now. They don't know what actually starts the process. That's the problem. But these plaques form in between neurons, outside of neurons in the brain. And the tangles are these long, stringy strands, these malicious strands that are formed from a substance called tau, and those form inside neurons. So it's kind of the 1-2 punch. You get the neurons kind of being squeezed out from one another on the outside by these plaques, and on the inside, the tangles are basically destroying the neuron from the nucleus on out.
Now, it was only at the beginning of this century that we began to recognize this was a disease, and I suppose that people weren't paying much attention to it because we didn't think many people had it. Has the number of people who suffer from Alzheimer's increased, or are we simply more aware of it now?
Oh, it's increased dramatically, and that is the story of us taking it seriously. Of course, I mean, it's always a personal tragedy when something like this happens, and I'm sure people in 2000 BC didn't like their, you know, 80-year-old loved ones, didn't like to see them deteriorating like this. It's just a horrible experience to go through. But only in the last 20 or 30 years have we had to take it seriously as a society because the numbers have gotten so big. And the reason the numbers have gotten so big is simply a function of how long we're living. At the beginning of the 20th century, life expectancy in industrialized countries was in the 40s, and now it's in the 70s and rising rapidly. And so as a result, we have this whole enormous new population of older people, and the percentage of those people who are getting Alzheimer's, it's the same percentage, but it's just a much larger group of people.
So how big a group of people is it now, do you know?
In the United States, in the 70s, there was an estimated 500,000 people at any given time that had Alzheimer's disease. Now it's an estimated 5 million.
And that's just in this country?
Just in the United States, and we're probably talking about something like 12 million worldwide. And this is before the big jump. The big jump comes after the year 2011 when the baby boomers start to turn 65 and start to get this disease in significant numbers.
So I suppose this means for the first time we're going to have generations of people who are never going to get out of the business of caregiving. I mean, they send their kids off to college and then turn around and take care of their parents before they, in their own lives, need to be taken care of.
That's absolutely right. And you just see this time and time again, exploring the lives of caregivers. It's just so common for women, particularly for whatever reason, to be in the situation where they've literally, just as you say, just sent their kids off to college and, you know, should be in the prime of their life with a whole new amount of freedom and, you know, exploring new possibilities. And lo and behold, their elderly parents are now having to be taken care of, and not just taken care of for a disease that will, you know, go away in a year or two. We're talking about a disease that lasts 8 to 10 years on average and can last a lot longer. So it occupies an entire decade of these caregivers' lives.
You mentioned earlier that it's been around for a long time, long before anybody knew to diagnose it. You even suggest King Lear might have been a victim of Alzheimer's?
Well, King Lear, you know, the Shakespeare scholars get upset when I talk about this because I don't want to assert that the play is about Alzheimer's disease. It's obviously about this family drama. But the fact is that there were some 50 versions of the Lear story before Shakespeare himself tackled it. And in none of those cases did senile dementia come into it. The character of Lear was not as old and he wasn't senile the way he is in the play in Shakespeare's version. And in fact, what historians have done is located an actual case of senile dementia. This fellow named Brian Annesley, who was taken care of by his youngest of three daughters, in fact. The two older ones were trying to get at the money, and the youngest one was actually more concerned with taking care of the father. So it mirrors the play in that way. And this person would have been in Shakespeare's social circle. So actually now, if you go to the restored Globe Theater in London, they've got a reference to the Brian Annesley case in the brochure if you go to see Lear, as I happen to do this summer in London.
You open your book with an anecdote about Mark Twain going to a dinner to have fun with Ralph Waldo Emerson and coming out of it ashamed, I guess, because he discovered that Emerson may well have had senile dementia.
Yes, they invited Twain to skewer Emerson and some other wonderful Brahmin writers. And I guess maybe the inviters didn't know what Emerson was going through either, because they probably wouldn't have asked Twain to do this. But certainly Twain didn't know what was coming his way. He got to this hotel and started one of his famous long tales after a dinner at midnight, and for a long time drew out this tale about three miners who had taken on these literary names. These were, you know, poachers, basically, and they were doing bad things to people in the mountains. And one of them was named Emerson, and he, in the course of this hilarious speech, he skewers Emerson by taking his poetry and turning it around and making Emerson seem like this kind of bawdy thief. And Twain was shocked to see that no one was laughing. No one laughed at all. It was just dead silence. And he ended up sending letters of apology and got a letter back, not from Emerson himself, but from Emerson's daughter, who explained that Emerson had neither understood nor remembered at all what had happened in that room. And that's one of the reasons why there was so much silence.
Jonathan Swift, who was famous as a satirist, apparently suffered from Alzheimer's as well. And he knew it and wrote about it. Is that right?
Jonathan Swift is one of those people who was deathly afraid of senility throughout his entire life because he'd seen his uncle go through it and made several predictions that that's what would happen to him. And unfortunately, he was right. Before that happened, before it even began to onset, but as he was getting old, he wrote a poem about himself called Verses on the Death of Dr. Swift. And in part, it reads, "Poor gentleman, he droops apace. You plainly find it in his face. That old vertigo in his head will never leave him till he's dead. Besides, his memory decays. He recollects not what he says. He cannot call his friends to mind. Forgets the place where he last dined." So if you know anything about senile dementia, you know that he knew a lot about it and was clearly...
And he knew what was coming.
He did. He did, unfortunately. And he was correct about his fate.
So is there hope for a cure? Are we on our way? I mean, no one researcher whispered to you 10 years till a cure. Is anyone else that optimistic?
There is hope. There is absolutely hope. Only in the last couple of years has there been any hope. There are just thousands of scientists spending millions and millions of dollars in research. And now, of course, it's a vital race for pharmaceutical companies because they sense a lot of profits in the making here. They are going to cure Alzheimer's disease. I don't know when it is. I can tell you that I'm 35 years old, and I'm very optimistic that for my generation, if Alzheimer's is around by the time that we reach our elder years, it's not going to be recognizable because I'm sure there will be some treatments that are much better than they are now. Whether or not they're going to come up with something to help the people who might be getting the disease in 10 years, well, that's the big question. It's this giant race, maybe the best scientific race of all time, against the clock to try to beat this disease before the disease mushrooms in the brains of baby boomers.
David Schenck spoke to me about his book, The Forgetting.